You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And with today being the second Wednesday of the month, between 12 and 1's always our legal hour, and we're really grateful that Grant Hutchinson supplies us with some people, and we can discuss various aspects of the law. We can't discuss cases, but if you've got anything you want discussed in the next hour, give us a ring. Greg's out there, 59-615-991, 59-615-991. We've got a few questions we want answered anyway. But first of all, welcome to Grant. Grant's the big chief down at Grant Hutchinson. Welcome, Grant.
G'day, Alan. It's great to see you, having tried to speak to you over Christmas, but I see you've still got Christmas decorations here.
Oh, have we?
Alan, tell you what, if only the listeners could see how much tinsel goes into this place.
That's how much effort we put into it. Lena, welcome.
Thank you.
Lena's the first time you've been with us?
Yes, first time.
Lena, you'll have to come in a lot closer to the microphone, I'm afraid.
All right, can you hear me now?
Yeah, can now.
Yeah.
And Zena, Zoe, we've also got Zoe. Welcome,
hi.
Zoe.
Thank you.
Happy New Year to you all. Now, Lena.
Did you try and call them Lena and Zena? Like sisters?
No, what did I say?
I thought you called her Zena.
Zoe.
Oh, yeah. That's all right.
Lena and Zoe, I think. Hey, look, he's trying to put me off already. And I've got to say, Happy New Year, or Happy New Year to the lot of you, because it's the first time we've had...
Every year's a happy breakfast. Year when you're in the legal profession, because you can help so many people.
And make plenty of money. No.
That's what radio presenters do.
I don't mean that at all. Lena, prior to Christmas, we asked about... a person's criminal record, particularly if they were committed fairly low key when they were 18 or 19, whether they were done away with or whether they stayed with them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. So the question I think that was posed was whether your criminal history can be wiped in 3 years. So 3 years post the crime. The short answer is no. So this space wasn't really regulated in Victoria. There was no piece of legislation or statute that regulated this up until last year. So on the 1st of July of last year, the Victorian government actually introduced the spent conviction scheme. So this just means that if you were to commit a crime in Victoria prior to last year and you were found guilty, there was no statutory right to prevent the disclosure of this crime, regardless of how much time had lapsed in between.
Right.
But since the introduction of this Spent Conviction Act, your criminal history can essentially be what the term they use is spent. So it can technically be wiped if the crime wasn't a serious conviction and you did not commit any further crime post the original crime.
Would it make any difference if you had a crime?
Yep.
Now, we're not talking murder or anything like that, because they're never going to do that.
Because that's a serious conviction.
So what are we talking about non-serious? Like, what would be the worst of that?
Non-serious would be anything that did not give you a sentence of 2.5 years. So anything less than 2.5 years that you of a term of imprisonment would be considered as a non-serious.
So, and the same thing with a fine or anything like that. That's going to be...
That's correct.
All right, so what about in the case of the children's court?
Yeah, so if you were convicted of a crime and you were under the age of 18, then the waiting period in that instance would be 5 years. So you commit a crime when you're under the age of 18 and then you don't commit any further crimes for the next 5 years, then that will be considered as wiped, essentially.
All right, so whether it be the 5 years or the other one we're talking about, if that's... if you commit another crime...
Yep.
Does that then stay there forever, or do you have to do another 5 years or whatever?
Yeah, so if you commit a crime within the 5 years, then that 5 years starts again with the new crime.
All right, so it can still be wiped.
It can still be wiped.
What we were getting at, somebody asked us a question that, you know, they'd been caught for shoplifting and went to the children's court. It might not have been the children's court. But then later on they wanted to join a bank as a bank teller or something.
Yep.
They wanted to know whether that can be held against them. So in the few years it could be. After 5 years, though, it couldn't be.
No, if it's near, if they didn't get a term of imprisonment for more than 2.5 right. years, it'll be wiped automatically even right. after the waiting period.
Sounds terrific to me. All right, look, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more on music memories and more. That's on a Sunday on Community Connections. Again, so far we haven't had anyone ring, but if you'd like any questions, give us a yell and we'll soon get them answered today for you.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Zoe, we're going to ask you a question. We haven't heard from you yet.
Yep.
So when you go along to a solicitor, and we've talked about that you really don't want to be told whether the person's guilty or not guilty, but how involved should a solicitor get, or should they just be very stony-faced and just listen to the facts and then just give you the advice?
Yeah, so it's a real balancing act. Obviously, you don't want to be stony-faced and cold because that's not going to make people feel very supported in their legal issues. But again, you need to remember your role as the lawyer is essentially helping them navigate the legal system rather than a counsellor or something like that.
And how often, I think I've asked Grant this once before, but from your experience, how often do you get where you actually listen to to a person, they come in, they lay the case out in front of you and you think, oh, this is hopeless, we're never going to win this. Do you get that happen very often?
I mean, it depends. The merits of the case really depend on the evidence you have, things like that, but I mean, nothing's ever completely hopeless. You can always give advice on other avenues they can look at, things like that. Oh. So as long as they're being honest about their experiences, you can usually help them, direct them in some kind of way.
Now, you've just touched on a question there, which I was going to ask you. How often do you find that the client is dishonest with you?
Well, there's no way of knowing exactly unless you've got direct proof that they're lying, which is a different situation. But if you suspect they're being dishonest, you can just guide them in the right direction, remind them of their obligation, especially if they're speaking in court, that you have to be directly honest and just work with the facts that you've got rather than any speculation or opinions.
Well, I guess the problem is too that if they're lying to you, it's going to blow up in the courts in their face anyway, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the lawyer's job, it's sort of an ethical duty to the court as well, rather than just to the client. So if we can see that someone's intending to lie to the court or be dishonest, it's really our job to guide them back towards honesty and the truth and focusing on the facts of the case as well.
Well, that sounds fair. Well, because as you say, I think one of your other partners told me one day that, that your first duty is to the court, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not necessarily your client.
Yeah, that's right.
And then after that, you've got to give your client the best advice to try and get them the best outcome, don't you?
Yeah, within those bounds of that duty to the court. So the first thing is you have to be honest and ethical, and then within that you try your best to help the client as much as you can.
Grant, have you ever had anywhere where you've gone into a case honestly believing that the person's told you all the truth, only to find out the prosecution blows it up in your face because that what you've been told is just not right?
I remember more of a civil matter where there was we'd been told the facts are X, Y, and Z,
yep.
And during the course of cross-examination or during the course of the trial, became apparent that having had the witness give the evidence that the position was X, Y, and Z, became clear that it was X, double Z. So it was different, and we had to adjourn the case and say to the client, have it stood down while we explain to the client, if you now want to, if you know, unless you're prepared to tell the truth to the court,
yep.
Given what you've told us and we know that that wouldn't be the case, we will have to cease to act and you'll have to begin again another lawyer.
Yep.
So who would then, you know, and whether or not, depends on what you tell the new lawyer.
Yep.
Actually, in that case, they hadn't given their evidence, so they were yet to give the evidence, but what they told us was the truth. They were then telling us that they were going to say something different in the witness box that wasn't the truth, and we just said we wouldn't act. So that the court stood it down, and that person had an opportunity to engage new lawyers,
right,
who he was able to tell the facts were X, double Z,
yep.
And when he came to give his evidence, it was X, double Z.
Well, that's fair enough.
And so that lawyer didn't have to, but if you've told us, it's the truth is very important. It fundamentally is built, the whole system of justice, and it's not that we can achieve it in and of ourselves, but we can certainly distort it. We can certainly fundamentally erode it if we're part of a system where we participate in lying. And
yep.
So the court cannot tolerate, and we're officers of the court, and
yep.
We have an obligation to the court. And so that's why our first duty is to the court. But it's not a duty to the exclusion of the ability to look after our client, but rather we can look after our client at the same time. And certainly we put our client's interests well above any thought of the other client, the person on the other side.
Right. But, and also part of your job is, I guess, or no, I'm asking, I suppose I shouldn't say I guess, is to make the prosecution prove their case. Is that
absolutely
part of it, isn't it?
You're quite right. The prosecution, we don't have to prove the innocence. There's a presumption of innocence on
yep.
the part of a person
yep.
before the courts, and that's in a criminal sense, presumption of innocence until proven guilty. So there may be a chance when you don't even have your client give any evidence. So,
because the prosecution's case is weak, or?
Well, the prosecution has to prove their case.
Yep.
I think if, so we don't want to discuss a particular case, but the case where a man in Canberra was being sued for an alleged rape.
Yep.
Yep. So we're not going to get sued for defamation or any of that.
No, I'm not
we're going to stay away from that. But he didn't give evidence in that case.
Right.
It was a criminal case. He was up on trial and he chose not to give evidence, and that's his right.
Yep.
He's presumed innocent unless, as soon as somebody gets in the witness box, once you're finished with what's called the examination in chief, which is where your side asks you the questions.
Yep.
You're up for cross-examination, and cross-examination can be a wild experience. It's not limited to the... It can go anywhere. It's got to be hopefully relevant.
The judge has the final say, doesn't he, how far it goes?
Yeah, I don't want to pull you up on you saying the judge being a he, but let's just say the judge.
The judge.
In that case, it was a female judge. And
yep.
So the judge has to apply that. Make sure that the rules of evidence are applied, and there are
yep.
certain rules around. You can't say, I was told by so-and-so that this other person said this, so it's hearsay evidence.
Yep.
So the things that you and I might say when we're in conversation with another and get away with presenting something as the reason you should believe this version is because I heard so-and-so say about so-and-so. Yep. The courts say that's not admissible evidence. That's not appropriate. You, when it comes to the finding of guilt by a person, you can't do that. And but when you're in cross-examination, you become, I wouldn't say the property of the cross-examiner, but you're on the line. They'll go everywhere to call into question your credibility, reliability, your anything. And could be something you've done that's got nothing to do with that incident that calls into question your ability to tell the truth. And it's who wants to go there? Is there anyone? No. I've not met anyone who is without ever having said or done the wrong thing. I've not met them yet. Unless it's you. Unless it's you, Alan, of course. And Zoe and Linda, of course.
All right, we're just going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
There was a friend of mine on murder. Judge's gavel fell. Jury found him guilty. Gave him 16 years in hell. He said, I ain't spending my life here. I ain't living alone. Been breaking the rocks from the chain gang. Breaking out and heading home. I'm gonna make a change. Sky. I'm gonna make a jailbreak.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and of course, being the second Wednesday of the month, we were on our legal hour with the people from Hutchinson Legal. We've got Grant, we've got Lena, and also Zoe. Now, Grant was talking about lying in court, and we all know that if you go down that track that you can wind up with contempt of court and all sorts of stuff, and that's not a good way to go. But there's quite a lot of this stuff is done in mediation. So you're not in a court, you haven't got a judge in front of you. Mm-hmm. What happens if someone lies in mediation?
So it's definitely not recommended to lie in mediation. It's not recommended to lie in general. However, a lot of people can tend to bend the truth, especially because whatever is said in mediation generally cannot be used as evidence in a courtroom. So knowing that some individuals may take advantage of that and may try to bend the law. But as Grant mentioned earlier, we are the officers of the courts. And so it's really our duty to the courts as well as to our clients to maintain honesty and integrity throughout any process, even though it's not in a courtroom. So even though it's in a mediation.
So how do you get some idea that a person's starting to lie in mediation?
You would listen to the facts. If they are, if they say one version of a story and then they say it again and then some things may be missing or...
Can I just stop you there?
Yeah.
Only because I don't like to stop him, but so that we can cover the whole lot.
Sure.
So you will have already... You don't go straight into mediation, do you? So you will have already had one or two appointments with your side for the mediation, won't you?
So mediations are generally court-ordered. So it's a process that happens outside of court to expedite the court process. So it's court ordered. It's something that you'd have to do to come to a settlement. So if you cannot come to a settlement in the courtroom, it's your order to do it outside the courtroom and then come back with a resolution.
Right. So I'm sorry, I didn't want to cut across you.
Sure.
So you have already heard their story at least once before. So that's if they start to change their story, in mediation, what would you do if you were part of that mediation?
I'm
talking about you, Lena.
Oh, me?
Yep.
If I heard a different version of events compared to the first. If I were to hear different version of events, you would definitely note it. It just depends on what type of mediation it is. If it's in relation to a contract, if it's relation to something else. So it really just, it depends on what type of mediation and what it's for. Right. But it's something that you would definitely flag to the other side. But
so would you stop the mediation and would you say to that person, hang on, we need to, because you wouldn't in front of the other people say to them you're lying, would you?
No. You would maintain that camaraderie in the mediation, but I've never been in that position, so right. I can't exactly say what I would do because that's never happened before.
But would you be inclined to stop it and say, I want a 10-minute break here, and take your client out and say, listen here, knucklehead, I believe you're starting to tell some lies.
So potentially you would ask for like an adjournment or you would, not an adjournment, but you would ask for a break, have a conversation, try to get back to the truth.
But not in front of the other side, would you?
I wouldn't do it in front of the other side.
No. All right. Grant's just had to leave us for a minute, so... Zoe, you'd like to talk about the victims of crime, and also, it's just somebody just mentioned that how would you go if you've been scammed? Are you entitled to any recourse through the victims of crime, or is it bad luck, or what?
So at Your Lawyer, we do victims of crime assistance, which is essentially when someone is a victim of an act of violence, then they can claim for... like assistance. It can be financial assistance, counselling, that sort of thing. So the base requirement there is there needs to be an act of violence. So it gets complicated with online crimes like cybersecurity scams sort of thing. So essentially, if you can't establish an act of violence, then you're not eligible for a victims of crime assistance application. So you would have to show that some sort of violence occurred.
An act of violence online?
In some circumstances, it can be. Things like stalking and harassment can be acts of violence. It is sort of a higher threshold because, obviously, a physical assault, it's quite easy to establish that violence was a part of that. But when it's online, it's a bit murkier. It's more of a grey area. But there definitely can be instances where violence can be established.
All right. So what are the parameters for getting... When I say parameters, what sort of... is there an upper limit of damages that you can get through the victims of crime?
Yeah.
And how hard is it to prove that that you've suffered loss?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not compensation in the way that the civil jurisdiction is. So you're not trying to essentially show that you've lost something and then get that back through financial compensation, through damages like you do in the civil jurisdiction. It's more just a token gesture of support for a victim of crime. So it's not as much as you could potentially get in the civil jurisdiction. There is a maximum financial payment of up to $10,000, and that depends on the type of crime. There's a scale to do with that. So it needs to be quite a serious crime to get that maximum amount. And then on top of that, there's up to $60,000 of support services. So that can be reimbursing medical expenses, paying for counselling and things like that.
Oh, very good. All right, look, we'll take a quick break. Grant's back and... we'll talk about class actions.
Yarra Valley FM acknowledges the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri people, as the custodians of this land we broadcast from. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging.
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, we'll just go back to what we were talking about, the victims of crime, because maybe we cut that off a bit too short. So, Zoe, you want to talk... there are various categories, and Lena's going to follow it up and tell us what those categories are.
Yeah, absolutely. So earlier we were talking about victims of acts of violence. We mentioned scams, harassment, things like that. So that's for people that have been a direct victim of something that's happened to them. And there's another area with victims of crime where a family member has died because of an act of violence. So if someone's been murdered or died in some sort of violent crime, then the family members can actually apply for victims of crime assistance in that instance. And when that happens, there's sort of a pool of $100,000, and that's split between each affected family member.
Is it proportional-wise? Like, say it was the wife, would she get more than, say, the parents or the kids, or is it just a figure for them all?
Yeah, so that's part of the job in making the application, and the tribunal considers the needs of each person and who's been more affected. For instance, some people might be more vulnerable than others and might need more counselling, whereas others might be doing okay. So it really depends on the situation. It's quite variable. So I'll hand over to Lena now, who can discuss the price category.
Just tell us, because I think you said there's four categories.
Yes, there are four categories for a primary victim. So there's different types of victims with the Victim of Crime Tribunal. So what Zoe mentioned was called a related victim. And then there are primary victims, and then there are also secondary victims.
So the primary one is the person that's being committed against.
Directly, yep. So that's directly affected.
Yep.
And then the secondary victims, the tribunal acknowledges that even though you haven't been directly affected from a crime, even hearing about a crime, so for example, if someone's been assaulted and another person has witnessed that assault, they can then develop PTSD or some form of trauma. So the tribunal acknowledges that, and they are also entitled to some assistance, and they are considered secondary victims.
So what's the four levels then?
So there's different types of categories. The lowest category just being a common assault, a threat to assault, threat to harm, and that you can receive up to $650 in that category. So that's category D. And then you move up to category C if you've been a victim of a serious crime. So if you were injured from an assault, then you would be entitled to up to $1,300. And then it goes up to category B. So this is a lot more serious crime. So crimes such as like sexual assaults, aggravated burglary, then the threshold is up to $3,250. And then the highest category is category A, and these are a lot more the most serious types of offences. So these are things such as like rapes, attempt to kill, then you will be entitled to up to $10,000.
And that's the person, though, that it's been against, isn't it? So
yes.
It's not like the other one where if it's their partner or something like that. The category A is just for the person that
category has been committed against. Category, these categories are only for primary victims. Yep. If you're a secondary victim, you are not... you cannot get any financial assistance in terms of the categories that we just mentioned. That's not available for secondary victims. Right. Secondary victims are entitled to services such as like counselling, items to assist in their recovery, but they don't get that special financial assistance. That's reserved for primary victims.
Which sounds fair. Look, I've got to take one more quick break, and then we've got a question for you to take away, and then we'll come back to Grant and we'll quickly cover class actions.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to the Legal Hour with the people from Hutchison Legal, Grant, Lena and Zoe. Now, we always like to send you away. Well, not send you away. We always have some questions from people, and we've had a couple of people, and it's talking about renting as to what should be in a lease if you're going to rent a place. Because at the moment I'm being told that renting is very difficult. That, you know, for everyone, I was talking to someone today and who talked about this, and they said, oh, they've been to somewhere, they have an open house and 30 or 40 people turn up and there's only one person going to rent it. So they want to get a bit of an idea what can be in a lease and what can't be, because they're a bit frightened. People are going to sign up to anything just to get a property. And this person themselves are trying to find out. They're a bit frightened that because it's so strict or hard to get, that some of the landlords may very well put in some undue clauses. They want to know what should be in and what shouldn't be, what's not allowed to be in. Are there any restrictions on what a landlord quite can put in? So if someone could come back next month, we'd love to hear that. Now, Grant.
Well, could I just clarify? I'm assuming that's residential, not commercial.
Oh, yeah, residential. Sorry. Yeah, okay. Residential. Yeah, yeah.
Great.
Righto. Now, class action. Now, one of your people, someone was talking the other day, wondered why there hasn't been a class action against some of these breaches of the, where all of a sudden there's stuff sold on the
dark web
or something. So, Grant, you want to talk a little bit about class action, so could we expand it to cover that too?
Sure, absolutely. So, first of all, what is a class action? Well, a class action is a court proceeding, a court action against either an individual or an entity, such as Medibank or Optus, if you're talking about those breaches.
I'm not mentioning any names.
Oh, well, look, we could name Lena.
No!
Anyway, against anybody, a hypothetical that is allegedly wronged a set or a class of people. So it could be all their customers, and it could be a huge set.
So you can't take one person. Oh, no, there would be.
Well, an individual can take another individual to court, or an individual or an organisation.
But that's nothing to do with a class action,
the advantage of a class action is you're assuming the same facts arise. So I happen to be a customer, and that organisation did not take, it's alleged, did not take proper precaution to protect my personal data, and as such, somebody's come along and stolen money out of my bank account.
Yep.
Purely hypothetical. I don't think this has occurred as a result. I mean, it has occurred in the world, but I don't think it's occurred as a result of the two that you might have mentioned. But it could have. So if there had been, you can claim compensation. It could be, just remember, when technology or when information gets out there, one of your fundamental rights is to privacy. And if the organisation is not protecting the information that they've taken from you and preserving your privacy, they're not preserving your information. This is part of a human right.
And once
to privacy.
Once it gets out there, there's no way of controlling where it's going to go, either with the internet now.
And what people might use it for. So, I mean, particularly tragic was if all your medical records got out there. So let's say you have sought very confidentially some medical treatment for particular things. You don't want people to be talking about that. That's your private information. It could cause you emotional distress. And it could cause the theft of that and somebody to then try and exploit you, because remember there's all of these so-called American military officers who fall in love with somebody online that aren't really American officers. But suddenly they need some money to get to visit you in Australia. It's just horrible what's out there. It's a pretty standard line that's run, but that can cause emotional distress. And if it's as a result of information that was given to an organisation and they didn't properly protect it, could you say that that's their responsibility? But going back to a class action, a class action is one where it has to have a minimum of 7 members, and you normally have a lead person who is going to be leading on the case. You don't so that you run it through and say, well, if it works for this one, hopefully they settle or there can be action or orders made more generally. So, and that's really for those people who are eligible to share in compensation, which is recovered. Can happen in product liability, can happen from claims by investors or shareholders, from consumer protection claims, from industrial claims, underpayment of wages, so employee claims. It can happen in environmental liability cases. So it can happen as a result of bushfires. The biggest payout that I'm aware of, it was the $494 million that was awarded in December 2014 as a result of a settlement with three defendants arising from the Black Saturday bushfires near Kilmore East and King Lake in Victoria in 2009. So were the power lines constructed or not maintained so that the bushes were back sufficiently? So it all arose out of the same thing. There could have been a class action. There was allegedly a fellow going around, an arsonist, lighting fires. If a whole lot of people, then the fire affected, 200 properties, could those 200 have started a class action against him? You normally want to know that the person you're taking an action against has money.
It's got some money, yeah.
Because it's no good getting a piece of paper that says, I'm owed $494 million unless there's somebody to pay it. Otherwise, I don't think lawyers want to run it. But remember Aaron Brockovich, that movie, and there was contaminated water, affected a whole lot of people. And so, I'm recognising we're running out of time. So it's just a fascinating topic we can come back to any time.
Brilliant. Could you maybe, when you're looking up stuff to bring back next time, could you have somebody have a bit of a look at the law regarding holding information? I'm not about talking about the privacy now. Why would any company need to keep a passport information or things like that where you only bought a phone account or something, which is not a lot of money, 20 years later? Why is there legislation that says right after 5 years it should be all deleted?
That's a great question, and I'm sure many boards are grappling with that issue as we, over the last few months. So, great question. We'd love to come back with an answer.
So, we have both the reading, that's and good. Also, surely there's something that says to people, you can't just keep this sort of information for 20 or 30 years. I mean, I would have thought once you've paid your bill once, twice, three, four times on time, then a lot of that stuff should have been knocked off.
You're a very trusting man, Alan.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, I've got to go. The news is knocking on the door. So thank you to Grant, Lena and Zoe for your time. Hope you've enjoyed the day with us. And we look forward to talking to somebody from Hutchison Legal March. Five weeks today, because I think there's five Wednesdays in, not sure. Anyway.
Whatever you say, Alan, we'll put in with you.